At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The old jokes about over-education and underemployment were usually aimed at liberal arts types. The booming information age needed engineers, technicians, programmers. But our guest tonight says, art history majors, rejoice, your day has come or is on the way. America's economic future, says Daniel Pink, rests on right-brain thinkers, conceptual, inventive, empathetic. Tonight on Point, an argument for the dawning age of the right brain, profiling the winning mind for a new century. But first, we begin tonight in Baghdad, where 2 months after much-heralded elections, a new government has still not been formed. Tomorrow, the elected National Assembly will hold its second meeting, but Newsweek reporter Rod Nordland in Baghdad says that without an agreed government, Iraq feels increasingly and dangerously adrift. I asked him why there is still no government in place.
It's extremely complicated. Basically, they have to put together a government that satisfies a lot of competing interests, and particularly that brings the Sunnis in a way that makes them happy without angering the Kurds, who have the second largest number of votes. And that's just proving really hard to do, really hard to find a formula, really hard to find personalities who are willing to do it. The latest news, you know, is that Ghazi Al-Yawar, the current president, has turned down the post that they were going to offer him of Speaker of the Assembly. And even that was just a modest step. You know, they were going to make him Speaker of the Assembly, have a National Assembly session tomorrow, and then adjourn again while they continued to try to hash out the other and actually more important members of the government.
Let's look at that just for a moment, Rod. It might be illuminating. Why would Ghazi Al-Yawar, the current interim president, refuse to take the Speaker of the Assembly post? Does he consider it too modest a post?
Well, he's the current president. He's going to become the Speaker of the National Assembly, which is not necessarily the most exciting post of all, especially when the style of government has basically been to organize everything off stage, behind closed doors, then have the National Assembly kind of meet and give their approval to it. It's not so far shaping up as a robust public body that's going to really determine how things go. I mean, it's all going to be done in caucus, basically. So maybe he's looking at it as not that big a plum. You know, the original idea was for the Shia, who clearly have the majority, to give the presidency to the Sunnis, but their partners, the Kurds, who they need to make a two-thirds majority to form a government, refused to accept that and insisted that one of theirs be the president, and they've had to agree to that. And that pretty much, as the Sunnis see it, cuts them out of the action.
Ghazi Al-Yawar, of course, a Sunni. Rod, is there still a fundamental confidence there in Iraq that this can be pulled off, that a government can be pulled together out of the representation resulting from the January 30th election? Or could there be a stalemate?
Well, I think people are starting to wonder now. The whole idea of having a government is that you want to have some kind of order in the country, something that people can rally around instead of taking their grievances to the streets and maybe eventually seeing the entire situation deteriorate into the civil war that a lot of us have expected to begin here at some point anyway among these very different groups that have a lot of reason to hate each other and not to want to get along. They very desperately need a government to bury those differences. And there are 2 months now since the elections. The elections were a tremendous moment in recent history. You know, they defied all expectations. Iraqis came out in huge numbers, and all the naysayers, myself included, were just amazed at this and very cheered by it. And now, 2 months later, they still can't agree even on the Speaker of the Assembly, one of the least important posts. It's a pretty drear prospect.
Rod, is there some kind of game of chicken going on here? People holding out, holding out, holding out. And if there is, what does anyone gain by not pulling a government together ultimately?
Well, if there's a game of chicken, it's a game of Kurdish chicken. You know, the Kurds have something like 25 to 27% of the seats in the National Assembly. And that's enough for them to be the kingmakers, because in order for the Shia to put a government together, they need to take their 55% and come to 66%, and they need the Kurds for that. And the Kurds have been playing hardball with them and getting a lot of concessions and demanding more and more. Some people think at the last moment they'll say, okay, that's fine, we got as much as we can out of this, and now we'll play ball. But there's some pretty thorny issues that the Kurds feel very strongly about, the status of Kirkuk and their overall strength in the government and how federal it is versus how autonomous the Kurds are. And it may be that they don't come to an agreement. And the other issue is the Kurds do not want to see as much given away to the Sunnis who didn't participate in the elections as the Shia do. The Shia, although they dominate, you know, their leadership has said, let's bring the Sunnis in because that's the best way to keep the peace here. And the Kurds don't quite buy into that as much as the Shia leadership does.
So there's the meltdown scenario, a simple failure to put a government together. What about more immediately, the consequences on the ground in Iraq of not having a new government formed? We see plenty more reports of bombings and killings here. Does the absence of the new government prolong the insurgency or hearten the insurgency?
Sure it does. It kind of freezes everything because on the most simple basis, you know, signing contracts, say, for new helicopters or something, they can't do that now. They can't take long-term decisions. They can't make policy decisions that affect people's basic rights, and they can't let contracts for new construction and so on. Everything is kind of dead in the water, and it's like a ship floating without any propulsive system or any rudder, just kind of floating around in the water. I mean, the Americans are here and they're taking the biggest burden of the security on, but the whole point of this exercise, from the American point of view at least, is to get the Iraqis taking charge of their own affairs, and they're not doing that, and they can't do that until they have a government.
A hard waiting game in Iraq. Rod Nordland, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Rod Nordland is Baghdad correspondent for Newsweek. He spoke with us from Baghdad. In the 1990s, Americans looked like hands-down winners of the information age. But globalization, outsourcing, and the rise of new giants like India and China have people thinking again. People like our guest tonight, author Daniel Pink. The very set of skills, the fundamental way of thinking, he says, that made America great in the industrial and information economies was left-brained, logical, linear, analytical. And while that may have been good for the 20th century economy, it is not enough, he says, for America's 21st century challenges. Left-brain thinking, claims Daniel Pink, is getting left behind. The future, he argues, belongs to right-brain thinkers. Engineers, accountants, and lawyers, he says, need to muscle up their right-brain skills. High-concept thinking, invention, expressiveness, empathy need to transition from the mechanical to the meaningful. Tonight on Point, an argument for the right brain as the winning frame of mind for the 21st century. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you make of Daniel Pink's Revenge of the Right Brain? Have logic and analysis lost their competitive advantage? And is the information age really over in America? Can you imagine a future, a new job, where big concepts and deep empathy are more important than hard facts and basic skills? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Daniel Pink, contributing editor at Wired Magazine and author of the new book, A Whole New Mind, Moving from the Information Age to the Conceptual Age. Good evening and welcome, Daniel Pink.
Hi, Tom. Great to be on the program.
It's wonderful to have you with us, and we want to pull the curtain up on this big vision you've got. But just for starters, I mean, what are you describing here? A whole economy that's going to rest on kind of empathetic, expressive, art history majors? Can you really build an economy on artistry and empathy and emotion?
I actually think that you can, although these kinds of transitions don't take place in a blink of an eye. They take place over many, many years, and they happen very, very slowly, and it's sometimes imperceptibly. But the argument at the core of what I'm saying is that the sorts of left-brain skills, and I use left-brain as a metaphor, the sorts of left-brain skills SAT kind of skills, zeroing in computer-like on a right answer. Those kinds of abilities are necessary. They're still necessary, but they're no longer sufficient, and that the fault line between who makes it and who doesn't is going to be mastery of a set of abilities we've often overlooked and undervalued.
So you are sort of giving the bum's rush here to an awful lot of people who probably feel that they're well-educated and well-equipped for the new century. Computer programmers, engineers, lawyers, MBAs. What is it about the skill set that, as you say, was so successful in the last half century that you see as, I'm not sure what the right word is, irrelevant, outdated,
outcompeted? No, I wouldn't call it irrelevant. I would say, think of it, let's use a different metaphor. Let's use the metaphor, the scales are tilting away from these kinds of left-brain analytical SAT skills and more in favor of these artistic, empathic, and holistic skills. But as you're suggesting, or sort of as you're implying, this is a provocative kind of argument to make. And I actually have marshaled a very, very hard-headed, left-brain, cause-and-effect argument for why this is happening. There are three very powerful forces that I think are tilting the scales away from the sorts of abilities we've often overvalued and toward the abilities we've often undervalued.
And we're going to talk about those. You've got abundance, Asia, and automation. We've got a break coming up. I want to save getting into those. What kind of reception are you getting here, Dan Pink? Are people ready to buy into this, or do you have engineers throwing computer chips at you?
Well, as you can imagine, Tom, the response is somewhat bipolar. You have you say this to a group of designers or a group of artists or a group of nurses or a group of clergy people, and they say, Dan, you had me at hello. And you say it to a group of lawyers or engineers, and they want proof. They want an argument. And there really is actually, we can get to after the break, a very, very hard-headed argument for why this is happening.
Well, we'll do that. We're talking tonight about the winning mental makeup in an era of global competition. My guest is Daniel Pink. His book is A Whole New Mind. You can join us tonight. Do you buy the idea that computer programmers, engineers, and number-crunching MBAs are yesterday's big winners in the U.S. economy? Do you see a golden sunrise coming up for right-brain types, artists, inventors, big-picture thinkers? 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Daniel Pink. He's author of the new book, A Whole New Mind, Moving from the Information Age to the Conceptual Age. You might remember his book from the 90s, Free Agent Nation. He's a contributing editor at Wired Magazine. Provocative thesis out there, the claim that artists and creative types will be America's big economic winners in the 21st century. What do you think? You can join the conversation. Are you prepared to bet the U.S. economy on empathizers and creative types? And can you picture the MFA, the Museum of Fine Arts degree, as the new MBA? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Is this working for you or working against you? Dan Pink, you write, and you're provocative right throughout this. You say the keys to the kingdom are changing hands. The future belongs to a very different kind of person with very different kind of mind, to creators and empathizers, pattern recognizers and meaning makers. These people, artists, inventors, designers, storytellers, caregivers, consolers, big picture thinkers, will now reap society's richest rewards, and you're building it all around this left-brain, right-brain metaphor. I don't know if everyone's really up to speed on what you mean by left-brain, right-brain. What does this stand for?
Well, our brains are divided into two halves. There's a left hemisphere and the right hemisphere, and obviously we need both sides of our brains to do anything. But there are differences, functional differences, between the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere. And in the book, I actually start out the book by going into an MRI machine and doing a bunch of exercises to learn how my own brain works.
Right.
And I think that the structure of our brains offers a very powerful metaphor for understanding the contours of our time. The left side of the brain is logical, linear, sequential, deductive. The right side of the brain is holistic, artistic, empathic, simultaneous, big picture, synthetic rather than analytical. And I think that provides us a very convenient metaphor for describing the sorts of abilities it's going to take to get ahead. And the sorts of abilities that are characteristic of the left hemisphere are still absolutely necessary. There's no question about that. But they're no longer sufficient. And that the point of differentiation between people who make it and people who don't is going to be mastery of these more right hemisphere type skills.
You quote Coleridge saying, The truth is, a great mind must be androgynous. And I guess you're saying left and right going on here. And as we heard you describe in this hour, the scale's tipping toward the right-brained style of thinking. Speak to us in career terms, or at least as we've understood career profiles in the last couple of decades. Are you literally saying you think engineers, computer programmers, lawyers, I'm not sure why, MBAs are losers in this new economy? Why?
I think some of them are. I don't think they all are. I think what really matters more than the particular profession is the set of abilities that are going to enable somebody to get ahead. And I think at the core of all of this are three fundamental questions, and they go to these three forces we were talking about before the break. You have to look at what you're doing in terms of career advice. You have to look at what you're doing and ask yourself three key questions. First, can someone overseas do it cheaper? And for a lot of computer programmers, for a lot of accountants, there's a lot of accounting being done in India and in the Philippines. For a lot of financial analysis, that answer is yes. And if the answer is yes, you need to think about what you're doing. Second question is, can a computer or software do it faster?
This is the automation piece.
Automation. For certain kinds of professions, certain kinds of professions that are more or less, and here's one of the key words here, routine. Work that involves simply more or less following a script, following a recipe, following a formula, certain kinds of accounting, certain kinds of financial analysis, and yes, certain kinds of law, computers can do that better and faster. And the web has liberated all kinds of information that used to be the source of the monopoly for certain kinds of professions, including law. We can talk about that. I will reveal to your listeners, Tom, that a long time ago, in a moment
galaxy
of youthful
far,
indiscretion,
far away.
Yeah, a long time ago, in a moment of youthful indiscretion, I actually went to law school. Mm-hmm. So I can talk about why that was a bad idea. And the third factor, which I think is perhaps the most important factor, Asia, automation, and abundance. We live in a spectacularly wealthy society, deep into the middle class. And that has, I think, changed the stakes for business and for individuals navigating their own careers. I used to be a political speechwriter, too, and among the things that I did as a political speechwriter was traffic in startling factoids. And there are all kinds of startling factoids about how abundant American life is today. Example, let's take cars. It used to be the American dream that everybody could have a car. Mm-hmm. Well, today, there are more cars in America than licensed drivers. Or take this, one of my favorite startling factoids. I don't know how many of your listeners, or you, Tom, you don't have to reveal this, have something in self-storage. Okay, self-storage is a business devoted entirely to housing our excess stuff.
Acres and acres of little garage door storage bins.
It's a industry devoted entirely to excess. It is a $17 billion a year industry in America. The receipts from self-storage exceed motion picture receipts.
So why is self-storage and abundance going to have computer programmers and engineers down on their luck in this century and
here's the thing.
Touchy-feely types on top?
If you want to sell something in this kind of marketplace, getting it to work, getting it to be functional are table stakes. But it's not enough. That's why you have a premium now on design. So you can go into Target and get a designer toilet brush. You can go into Alessi and get a designer fly swatter. You can go back into Target and get a designer garbage can. Even the most utilitarian, mundane objects are being transformed into objects of desire.
So stuff alone is not enough. It has to have an allure. It has to have that kind of
an emotional
creativity
appeal, an aesthetic appeal, a spiritual appeal. And we can make fun of that. And actually, I think that some of the making fun of that is justified. But if you look at it this way, if you go and buy a toilet brush, it's going to represent 0.00000001% of your lifetime income. So why shouldn't it be cool? Why shouldn't it give you some moment of aesthetic pleasure?
Well, we see retailers succeeding on just that, Target building an enormous business just around design.
And Virginia Pistrell has a wonderful book called The Substance of Style that makes the case that all businesses have to abide by what she calls the aesthetic imperative. But there's another aspect of abundance that I think is extremely, extremely important here, and it is this. When I am on my deathbed, Tom, I think it's very unlikely that I'm going to look back on my life and say, you know, I've made some mistakes, but at least back in 2005, I snagged a designer toilet brush. I think it's very unlikely that that's going to happen. And what's happened is that all of this material well-being hasn't necessarily made us happier. And one of the great paradoxes of our times is that we've gotten richer and richer and richer, but our levels of satisfaction haven't increased. And I think that has hit a point of no return, and you have this widespread quest for meaning and purpose and transcendence, particularly among the baby boom generation, who typical baby boomer now has more of his or her life behind him or her than ahead. That's why you have these once exotic things moving to the mainstream. 10 million people meditating, 15 million people doing yoga. You even have, and I write about in the book about the rise of labyrinths, which seem these wacky exotic things, but they're becoming mainstream because people are looking for something more.
Okay, we've got to put a bookmark there and come back to that. You're getting a little bit ahead of what I can follow here, Dan. I mean, you're describing the economic activity flowing in behind that kind of dynamic. But let's back up for a second. You say right in your title that we are moving from the information age to the conceptual age. Now, for a lot of people, you know, it just seems like about the day before yesterday that the information age was the new news, was getting started. We're moving out of the information age to the conceptual age. What's that mean?
Ever so slowly, yes. What it means is that we're moving from an economy where the abilities that used to get you ahead. Remember, the information age was the age of what Peter Drucker famously called knowledge workers. Mm-hmm. These are people who did very well on their SATs. Well, I think that those sorts of folks are in for a somewhat rude awakening, and I think to a certain extent, computer programmers have already had that rude awakening. And we talk a lot about outsourcing. Outsourcing, as we just discussed, is one of three factors pushing it there. But I think that we're moving, that these three forces are pushing us out of one era of competitive logic, of who gets ahead in the economy, into another era. Now, these sorts of things don't happen overnight. They happen slowly over time. And you can look in some very unlikely places for evidence of this shift. I'll give you an example.
Please.
Let's take General Motors, okay? The head of General Motors, there's a new head of General Motors North America a few years ago, and the New York Times reporter asked him, how will your approach differ from that of your predecessors?
This is Bob Lutz, is that who we're talking
Bob
about?
Bob Lutz, right. Mm-hmm. He said, my approach is more right brain. I see us in the art business, art, entertainment, and mobile sculpture that coincidentally happens to provide transportation. Okay, that's kind of freaky. GM is in the art business.
Mobile sculpture.
Mobile sculpture, right. Look at the United States Army. The United States Army has found the most effective recruiting tool it has ever had. And you know what it is? It's a video game. It's a downloadable video game that offers potential recruits a simulated experience of being in the Army. So the Army is in the video game business.
Okay,
if you look
at
a country.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I can imagine. We know what an industrial age economy looks like. Lots of people in factories building things. And information age also brings to mind an image of lots and lots of engineers and computer programmers and, yes, maybe those MBAs and lawyers around them. This is a little harder to picture. I mean, how many people can sit around putting out Hollywood movies or designing toilet brushes for Target? Are there the numbers of jobs in this kind of economy that you described, Dan Pink?
Well, that requires something of a leap of faith. But that has always been the case. Now, let me give you an example of that. I grew up in Ohio while the Rust Belt was rusting. And I remember, you know, we're moving to an information economy, to what was often called a service economy. And I remember my own father saying to me, we can't have an economy where people don't make things. We can't have an economy where everybody is giving each other haircuts. That'll never work.
Right. And yet
we have this information economy. I mean, the idea that we're a service economy is so mundane, it's essentially meaningless. And it's not as if these functions disappear. It's that we get better at them. Let's take manufacturing. Okay,
yeah.
We only have about one out of seven people in this country working in manufacturing, but we still have the largest manufacturing economy in the world. We just got really good at it. And if you look at the set of abilities that are necessary in manufacturing today, if you go to a factory floor, there are not people who are screwing in bolts. There are people who are working in clean rooms, or you're people who are manipulating robots and punching things on computer screens. It's a very different set of abilities. The same thing is true, I think, with some of these left brain information age kind of professions. So financial analysts who simply execute transactions, That's not going to work anymore because you can do it online. You can those kind of functions can be automated. But financial analysts or financial professionals who turn into broader life planners who help understand people's true needs, those kind of folks will flourish. Same thing with lawyers. Okay, if you go to let's take an example from lawyers. All right, let's take an uncontested divorce.
Okay,
an uncontested divorce will uncontested divorce will cost you, depending on your jurisdiction, about $3,000.
Mm-hmm.
But actually executing an uncontested divorce essentially amounts to filling out forms, and it's only forms that a lawyer is authorized to fill out. So $3,000 for an uncontested divorce, unless you go to something like CompleteCase.com, which is a website where you can get an uncontested divorce for $249, because ultimately, like an uncontested divorce, the lawyering behind an uncontested divorce is very routine. It's filling out forms. So
you're going to a vending machine online, essentially,
something that simple and routine. Now, what it means is that lawyers who are only executing these very simple routine kind of functions are in big, big trouble. But it also means that lawyers who can go before a jury and tell a compelling story, will flourish. Lawyers who can sit in a negotiation, understand the unspoken subtleties, they are going to be fine. Same thing is true with accountants, although I think accountants are basically buoyed a little bit in the short term by Sarbanes-Oxley. But in general, I think accountants are in much bigger trouble.
The last time accountants became artists, though, I'm not sure it produced – I mean, we're seeing the outcome of that in the Bernie Evers trial and all over the place. Dan Pink, you've got us thinking here. Dan Pink is with us. His new book is A Whole New Mind, Moving from the Information Age to the Conceptual Age. We're still trying to get our heads around an economy built on artistry, empathy, and emotion. Listeners, you can join us, 1-800-423-8255. Matt is calling from Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I think the author's premise is very very insightful. However, I'm looking at it from a slightly different point of view. I'm not seeing it as a transition of usefulness in the economy. I'm seeing it more from a political perspective. I think an increase in empathy is critical for us to proceed politically in any kind of peaceful fashion. And I think there is indeed an atrophy of empathy that has to do with an atrophy of the imagination that actually has to do with the lack of exposure to art and, in particular, book.
Matt, let me ask you, do you believe, does it feel correct to you to project that we're moving into a century where it's going to be more hospitable to empathy, let's say?
Yes, I think it's, but I think it's critical. I think there's, we simply have to do that. We have to develop those skills, and we've let them atrophy.
Not just for economic reasons, but political as well. Matt, we've got it. I want to get to Dan before the break here. Dan, our listeners are already pushing us forward beyond the economic zone into the political. I mean, are you really describing, you know, things tend to follow the money, I guess. If you're saying that this kind of artistic, empathetic, emotional mind is going to become the economically predominant mind, do you anticipate that translating into a different politics as well? Matt's saying it needs to.
Perhaps. I think Matt makes a very, very interesting point. I mean, in the book, I talk about the six key abilities and that people will need to master in this emerging world. And one of the six is empathy. And I actually have – I mean, Matt makes actually in some ways a more nuanced and kind of more morally based case for this. I'm making a very, very pragmatic case for why empathy is important. Why is empathy important? You can't outsource it and you can't automate it. And therefore, there's a premium on it in an economy where other kinds of functions can be outsourced and automated. Now, if it has the additional effect of making our politics more compassionate or deepening our empathy for people around the world, fantastic. But Matt is also on to another very interesting point, and it is this. The abilities that I'm talking about here, which include design and empathy and story and what I call symphony and play and meaning, these abilities aren't really new. In fact, they are, to my mind, they are fundamentally human abilities. They are part of what makes us human. And as you said, I think, Tom, these muscles have been underworked, and we need to work them back into shape. But all of us harbor these capacities that I'm talking about. It isn't as if you have to – it isn't something that you can go to community college and get a six-week course in. These are fundamental human attributes. These are part of what makes us human, and I think that bringing them to the surface, an economy that brings them to the surface, could be an economy that makes us better off and also makes us better, as Matt is suggesting.
But aren't some people aren't people sort of given to lean one way or another? I mean, I'm sure that many right-brain listeners will remember the heyday of the mathematician. I'm not sure it's over, by the way. We'll have to talk about that. But and say,
no,
you
know,
I just wasn't a math guy. I mean, is this really something? If you're a left-brain person, are you really going to become right-brain just by wishing you were more empathetic, more creative, more playful?
No, not at all. What you would do, obviously, is you would read the chapters 4 through 9 of my book and see the wonderful set of exercises and tools and tips that allow you to surface these things.
Oh, boy, it's Pilates for the right brain here, coming right up.
But I do think that that we should take a break.
We will. We'll be right back with Dan Pink. His new book is A Whole New Mind, Moving from the Information Age to the Conceptual Age. Listeners, you can join us. Left brain thinkers, does this have the ring of truth to you? Is your job going abroad? Is it a little less valuable today? And right brain thinkers, are you feeling it? Does the future belong to you? Do you see it in your paycheck? Do you even have a job? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the winning mental makeup in an era of global competition, the claim that artists and creative types will be America's big economic winners in the 21st century. My guest tonight, Daniel Pink, is author of the new book, A Whole New Mind, Moving from the Information Age to the Conceptual Age. You can join us tonight. Can an economy be built on big concepts and empathy? And is this information age already ending in America? Are you seeing the conceptual age dawning? How's it look to you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Will is calling from Greensboro, North Carolina. Hi, Will. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
Great, thanks. What's on your mind?
I actually work in the computer field. I'm a computer programmer, and I'm listening, and I think his idea is somewhat idealistic in that I agree. It would be great to have more conceptual-based jobs, but like in the example with Target, there's only so many of those jobs to go around. One person designs it, and 500 people manufacture it. Like, it would be great if everyone could be a conceptualist or whatever, but there's only so many slots, and the overall framework is of capitalism and the you know, mass-producing, so there's less people designing. Like, in order for everyone.
Yeah, how many designers can you have? Are we going to be one designer for every brush buyer? Let us pick it up, Will. Dan Pink, how about it?
I think it's a very fair question. And as we were talking about earlier, there is a certain leap of faith required in all of this. But these are what I'm describing here is really nothing new. We've seen this movie before, and this is just the sequel. And these are the same sorts of questions.
But build a little bridge, that rickety bridge of logic across that leap of faith. I mean, the question is one I'm sure a lot of people are thinking. Well, how many designers and empathizers and storytellers can you have?
I'll give you an example already. There are more Americans today who are working in art, entertainment, and design than work as lawyers, accountants, and auditors. That's already happening today.
Okay.
And the economy seems to be in okay shape. We're not at the risk of an implosion. If you look at the single job that is in greatest demand today is nursing. Nursing is obviously is a very whole-minded profession. It requires a great amount of analytic ability, but it also requires things that are difficult to outsource or automate, particularly empathy and care and understanding of others. That's the job in greatest demand today. So there are these jobs. There are these jobs available. And also, let's go back to, I mean, Will said he's a computer programmer. The very best computer programmers, if you go out and interview computer programmers, the very best computer programmers tend to be very whole-minded and in some ways very right-brained. They're the folks who are architecting entire systems. So the sorts of computer programming, let's take that as an example. Mm. Certain kinds of computer programming work, and it's work that takes brain power, and it's work that has provided very good salaries for a long time. Things like fixing bugs, maintaining software, fabricating software, that kind of work is going to disappear overseas. Now, again, the main point about outsourcing is that outsourcing is massively overhyped in the short term and massively underhyped in the long term.
You mean more jobs than we can imagine will go, ultimately?
I think that if you just do it the left brain math, let's talk about outsourcing just for one moment, because I spent some time in India researching this book and meeting with some of the computer programmers. India will be the largest English speaking country in the world by 2010. That's a remarkable thing. The United States will no longer be the largest English-speaking country in the world.
Because such a large portion of India's billion-plus population will be fluent in English.
If you're taking percentages of very large numbers, okay, this is math here, man. This is not, you know, wishful thinking or creativity. Mm-hmm. This is just math. Mm-hmm. Okay, if you take relatively small percentages of a very large number, it adds up. So let's say that 15% of India's population achieves middle-class status. That's 150 million people. That's larger than the entire U.S. workforce. Okay, that's more workers than we have in the United States.
You know, we see that. We see what's out there.
And they're connected for free by fiber optic cable. Mm-hmm. So anyway, but what this means is that the kinds of routine left brain work will increasingly disappear overseas. But there's plenty of work for computer programmers who can cross boundaries, that is, who can work with a team of programmers in the United States who are being the architects and a team of programmers in India who are doing the more routine maintenance and bug fixes.
That seems to come back to Will's question, though. I mean, how many architects can you have? Isn't it the routine jobs that create the mass of jobs?
I don't know. That's the honest question. The honest answer to that question is I don't know. I mean, we cannot. If you look at any projections of what actual jobs will exist, say 10 years from now, they're almost always wrong, because we always underestimate the ingenuity of people. We always underestimate the ability of people to come up with cool, interesting, fantastic things to do.
Yep.
Who can invent products we didn't know the world was missing. But it is, there's no question, there is a leap of faith involved here. Just as there was a leap of faith when we went from the farm to the factory, when we went from the factory to the cubicle, and now we're moving from the cubicle to a world of creators and empathizers,
and
people who again can do things that computers can't do faster, that people overseas can't do cheaper, and that appeals to some of these non-material yearnings of a very abundant age.
And there's the horizon that Dan Pink is painting. Carrie's calling from New York City. Hi, Carrie, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, I'm an MFA student.
MFA, Master of Fine Arts. So you're the described one here.
I'm getting an MFA in sculpture at Hunter College in
New
York.
Okay.
Just excited that you're recognizing the innovativeness and the creativeness that fine arts people have, because right now, as I study for this degree, I'm also in the regular workforce. And I mean, I'm constantly, one of the things I like best about doing art is that things are always changing and you always have to find a way to build something to make you create a structure for a sculpture or drawing or painting. And I feel like those skills are totally applicable into the workforce.
Carrie, let me ask you, if I may, we hear your passion for that. Do you make the leap of faith, along with Dan Pink, that in this century, in this global economy, that will translate into you being an economic winner?
I have to believe in that. I have to believe in that, because that's a part of what I do, and I believe that it's going to, one way or the other, no matter what, you know, vocation I end up in, whatever job, it's going to have some of what he's been talking about.
Feels like it's
and
on
also
the way.
Tom,
yes,
and
Dan.
Also, Tom and Carrie, you know, we just heard that General Motors is in the mobile sculpture business, and here we have a sculptor.
Yeah, but General Motors is going broke as well. Right. We're also reading that in the newspapers in recent days. I mean, I'm all for mobile sculpture, but just adding it all up.
They need better sculptors, apparently.
I guess so, Carrie. Be that sculptor if you like. Mitch is calling from Boston. Hi, Mitch. You're on the air.
It's good to meet you. That was funny. I think there's something to this thesis, but I had hoped, if you've read, recall William James, I'm always a dead white man, but had something to say. I was hoping that you would say that we're moving towards a perceptual age, not a conceptual age. If you recall, William James, you know, says that there's concepts, right?
Yes. Mitch, you blanked out on us there for a second.
You know, it's because of call waiting. But what I'm saying is percepts and those concepts, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's that where the truth is in the percepts, is in tone of voice and body language and syntax and color and notes, and that's where art comes from. And it's in the realm of experience, not big, you know, abstract theories. So I think in a way, this kind of grand systematic theorizing is actually rather left-brained, and I don't know.
You've still got Dan Pink corralled back on the left side, but he's talking right. He's talking a big game on the right. But Dan, in fairness, you've got a lot of what Mitch is talking about, that you're describing storytellers, consolers, not just high concept, but people putting that kind of very artistic, empathetic way of thinking or personality to work. Do you see careers in that for millions of people?
Yes, I do. And again, I think that there's an economic imperative that that underlies it. I think that that Mitch makes a very interesting point about William James and the importance of experience. And I think that there are all kinds of professions that will emerge and that already are emerging. As we mentioned before, we have more Americans working in art, entertainment, and design than working as lawyers, accountants, or auditors. And that there'll be all kinds of professions that will emerge as we go through this. But one of the other things that William James talked about is the pursuit of meaning and purpose. And I think that is extraordinarily, extraordinarily important. So if I have to give career advice to anybody, which inevitably a book like this that triggers that kind of question, I don't go around telling people, young man, go be a designer, or young woman, go be an empathizer. I mean, I think that the fundamental thing, and perhaps one of the biggest things going on, is this pursuit of meaning and purpose that an abundant society has allowed us to do. So if I offer career advice to kids in college or in high school, I say, listen, find out what you love to do, find out what you're great at, and do that. Now, it just so happens that there have been a lot of people in this country who have loved design, who have loved art, who have been very empathic people, who love caregiving, and were great at it, and that we've often undervalued their abilities, we've often overlooked them. And I think that those sorts of things that set of people are great at are really going to flourish. I don't know if someone says, if you ask someone deep in, you know, in their soul, what do you love to do and what are you great at, they're going to say accounting.
Well, some may, if they're truly left brain, they may take a lot of pleasure in that. But let me ask you on the other side. You're talking about caregivers here. Now, for a long time, those have not been the best paid jobs in this country.
No way.
Are you saying that caregiving, when you say they're going to flourish, are you saying they're really going to become affluent caregivers? Is that an oxymoron? Is there really such a new age coming home care aides are going to be the... You know, Mercedes driving.
No. Affluent is an overstatement. But if you look at something like nursing salaries are increasing and increasing and increasing. This country is importing nurses and exporting computer programmers because there is, again, it's supply and demand. There's a greater demand for nurses and not as large a supply of them. Mm. And that's when salaries go up.
We've got so many people who want to join us. Let me turn to them. Rich is calling from Harvard, Massachusetts. Hi, Rich. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I think Mr. Pink is missing the boat completely. What I glean from his comments is that we're talking about basically everybody's going to be at the upper end of the bell curve, and it doesn't really matter how you characterize the bell curve, whether we're talking about intellectual ability or ability to produce something. And what it reduces to is that it's nice to have empathetic or empathic jobs there, but unless you create wealth in some way, who's going to pay for this? And there are only like three ways you can create wealth: manufacturing, mining, agriculture. That isn't really an empathic or an empathetic pursuit. So, you know, it's a bell curve. It's tiered, and unless you have the means of wealth production, you're not going to have a whole lot of empathetic luxury.
Rich, I hear. Are you saying that even now you don't see Hollywood, for example, as a wealth creator, just a wealth harvester? Is it you're saying it's only tin mines and factories?
Well, you know, traditionally, conventional wisdom, and although I don't necessarily subscribe to conventional wisdom, but throughout history it's been true. The only three ways you can create wealth are production, and those three production methods are agriculture, mining, and manufacturing.
Let us pick it up. Our time is short, Rich. Dan Pink, Rich wants you
The second largest export industry in this country is motion pictures, which doesn't fall into any of those three categories. That doesn't include anything like financial services. It doesn't include anything like management consulting. It neglects the entire healthcare sector. So I think he's flatly wrong.
Let me ask you a question extending from that then. One of the things we're looking at now is a trade balance. It's incredibly out of whack. Can you balance a trade deficit on these kind of right brain skill sets that you're talking about? I mean, we've been told we've got to export things sooner or later to India and China in order to balance that trade deficit. Can it be done on this right brain model?
Yes, because it doesn't mean that the rest of the other sectors of the economy are still going to, are going to disappear at all. It is in the same way that when we went to the information age, the manufacturing sector didn't disappear. We still have the largest manufacturing sector on the planet. I guess the answer to the question is sure. I mean, that's how these transitions from one economy to another operate.
We're out there. We've got our binoculars. We're looking at that horizon with you, Dan. Dave's calling from Boston. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to point out, I'm a PhD student in environmental science and engineering.
Is your world falling apart tonight, Dave, as we have this conversation?
No, I think Dave's in good shape, actually.
No,
I'm joking, but yeah.
No, because, I mean, I just want to point out that some of the greatest scientific researchers of all time have essentially been very left-brained in what they did. Either if they were mathematicians or computer scientists.
You mean right brain? That is empathetic at the same time that they had
I mean left brain. I'm sorry. I mean they've been very left brain because left brain people can visualize things, can visualize mathematics and molecules and things like that.
But you're saying there's that design sensibility, that sensibility of artistry is there in these scientific thinkers?
Yeah, and great science. Good scientists and good engineers have to be very creative and to solve the problems. To solve the problems that we face. We can't just put that out on designers. I mean, it takes all kinds of skills.
Absolutely. Right? So be that androgynous mind that Coleridge writes about. Dan Pink?
Amen to that. And one of the key abilities that I talk about is the ability of symphony, which is the ability to see the big picture, to put the pieces together, to combine disparate things into things that the world didn't know it was missing,
and
the greatest scientists of all, Newton to Darwin to Feynman have had that ability in droves, and it's the scientists who are doing the more routine stuff who might be in trouble. But I actually think that the field of environmental engineering, as people become more concerned about meaning and sustainability, offers a lot of opportunities.
Meaning,
so Dave's going to be fine.
Meaning, artistry, empathy. And you're saying this turf is not out of bounds to anybody. Everybody can lean this way, and if they want to succeed in this century, should.
I think that's right. I mean, if we had this conversation, Tom, 60 years ago, and we were saying, there would no doubt be callers saying, well, some people have to resign themselves that the only thing they can do is screw bolts into fenders, and that not all of us can do this intellectual work like being an accountant or a lawyer, and that's nonsense. And I think that these particular abilities that I'm talking about, design and story and symphony and empathy and play and meaning, are part of what makes us human. And all of us have them, and we just need to call them out of hiding.
Daniel Pink, you keep us thinking, opening our eyes, looking ahead. Thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Tom, it's been a real pleasure. I've enjoyed it.
Daniel Pink, contributing editor at Wired Magazine, author of Free Agent Nation. His new book is A Whole New Mind, Moving from the Information Age to the Conceptual Age. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Rachel Dornhelm, Eileen Amata, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Tim Skog, Michael Garth, and Angel Cazelli. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.